History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And we've learned, of course, that they don't have to go untold as long as we're willing to do something about it. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We aim to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, what we find is that not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. One of those stories we heard on the program many, many years ago played a role in inspiring a book that comes out this week, a book that is the culmination of years of research and interviews with dozens of World War II veterans. It was a quest ignited by the legacy of an uncle the author never met. The book is called Bombing Hitler's Hometown. I have it linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. The author is Mike Cresant. But before I welcome him in, I have to say, it's not just the book that you'll find captivating, but the website that Mike has assembled to supplement the book and really bring it to life with photos and background information. It's really, really impressive. If you're a multitasker, you might even want to browse around the site while you listen today. Among the photos you'll find there are some of Dale Shabilsky, an ex-prisoner of war whose story we had the privilege of hearing way back in 2010 on Hometown Heroes. So MikeCresant.com is the website. I have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and we welcome in the author, Mike Cresant, author of the new book, Bombing Hitler's Hometown. Mike, how far back does this quest, this mission, this project go for you?
The story goes back for me to 2011 when I began a journey to learn about my uncle. My uncle is Ellsworth Cresant, who was a bombardier in the 459th Bomb Group, which is one of the elements of the 15th Air Force operating out of southern Italy in World War II. There was the 8th Air Force in England and then the 15th Air Force in Italy. My uncle tragically passed away in a plane crash just after the war ended up in Wisconsin. He got an opportunity on short notice to hop on a plane and get pretty close to home. He'd been up in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, awaiting discharge. He hopped on the plane and the plane crashed. And this, of course, devastated the family, including my father, who was very close with Uncle Ellsworth. And I went through my life knowing that, you know, I had had an uncle who was in the war, didn't make it. Well, actually, he did make it, but he was killed stateside. And I just became curious. I got my dad talking about it. Word got out to my aunts, who all have a photographic memory. They helped me by providing information. And eventually I got all of his letters, or at least the ones that survived from the war. And I was able to piece together the bombing missions that he was on. And for each one, I would look at the target and study a little bit of the history of it, of the location, and maybe why the 15th Air Force struck that particular target. So I'm going through the list, and I come to Linz, Austria. This was in April 1945, April 25th, to be specific. It turned out to be the last time in Europe during World War II that the Air Force sent an entire Strategic Air Force after a single target. There would be a couple of smaller raids in the days to follow, but this would be the last time there was this huge force of bombers sent after a target. Linz, Austria, as I dug into it, turned out to be the town that Hitler considered his hometown. Now, let me explain that. Hitler, of course, was born in Austria, just inside the border with Germany. And right around age 9, the family moved to a suburb of Linz, and over the next 9 or 10 years, Hitler and his family lived in or near Linz, Austria. And Linz at that time was a city of about 60,000 people. It was a hotbed of German nationalism. particularly the middle school that he attended. So he found that appealing. And some of the key events in his early life happened there. His father passed away. You know, they had a strained relationship, to put it mildly. His little brother passed away at a young age. And then later his mother, who he was very close with, passed away. So it was a time of great change for Adolf Hitler. He was going through adolescence at the time. He didn't have very many friends. He didn't do well in school. However, he did become close with a young man named August Kubizek in 1904-05. The two became quite close. Kubizek was a music student. They went to the opera together. They would walk around Linz together. And Adolf would subject him to monologues about whatever popped into his head. Well, one night they went to an opera by Wagner, and we all know that Wagner really appealed to Hitler. And Kubizek describes in a book that he later wrote that they went for a walk, and Hitler launched into what he called a rapturous monologue, in which he, Hitler, transferred himself upon the character in the opera. It was called Rienzi, and it was about an Italian populist leader who led his people to glory. This is the only view we get, for the most part, into Hitler's young life. So it was very important. And Hitler would later tell Kubizek in a meeting that, quote, indeed, in that hour it began. So I'll skip over some history, but we all know that Hitler goes off to Vienna, becomes a failed student, ends up in World War I, and then as the Chancellor of Nazi Germany. Well, in March 1938, Hitler re-enters Austria at the head of a conquering army. And after stopping at his parents' grave, they make a beeline for Linz. And the town square is full of about 80,000 people, which is more than the entire population of the city. He gives a speech from a balcony that is still there in pristine form. And he launches into another one of his impassioned speeches and talks about sort of being the prodigal son and that this was his destiny, blah, blah, blah. Well, the reception he receives is so overwhelming and exhilarating that he decides then and there, according to some historians, to annex all of Austria. And this, of course, being one of the first steps toward what would become World War II. So as an adolescent, Hitler had always been sketching Linz, what he would do to the city. He hated a number of the structures that were there, so he would sketch what he would do if he could to change the city. Well, now, of course, he's in a position to do something about it. And he aims to make Linz the cultural capital of all of Europe. Specifically, he wants to create a museum called the Führer Museum, of course, where all of the artwork that his minions would soon begin stealing from all over Europe, all of that art would go in this museum. He would also retire in Linz and be buried there along with his parents. In order to pay for all of these changes, he has to raise tax money. So he industrializes Linz. The Hermann Goering Works are built in the eastern part of the city. They would produce steel there, as well as, later on, armaments, specifically tank chassis and other things. And Linz is, of course, on the Danube River, so there's also some production for naval craft. To go along with all of that, they enlarge the rail system, which was already quite formidable, but it becomes a major transportation junction in Austria. So let's fast forward again. We're now in April 1945. The war has long since turned against the Germans. And on April 12th, Vienna falls to the Soviets, who are advancing from the east. The Americans, specifically Patton's Third Army, are coming from the west. Before the Soviets take Vienna, the Germans are able to withdraw many of the anti-aircraft guns that were guarding the city. and they placed them in Linz. And I have an intelligence report from mid-April, which goes through all of this, and it states that not only have the anti-aircraft defensives protecting Linz increased by about 50%, but also Linz is now the hinge of German defenses in that part of Europe. 2,000 rail cars full of stuff are sitting in the rail yards there. So needless to say, Linz has to be taken out of commission. Although the 15th Air Force had been bombing Linz for almost a year, they had not met a lot of success. So on April 25th, the 15th Air Force goes after Linz. And because all of those anti-aircraft guns are there defending the city, the men are shot to pieces. And within the first 4 minutes, the first aircraft goes down. It's a B-24 with the 459th bomb group. And one after another, bombers are knocked from the sky. Ultimately, 15 would be shot down, and 28 Americans would lose their lives. That, in a nutshell, is the battle and why it happened. I was fortunate enough, I started the research for this late in the lives of many of the veterans who were there. And I began looking up as many of the men as I could find, you know, doing research in the archives and in histories. And I reached out to probably 100 veterans, and I heard back from about 55 and interviewed them. Many of them had never spoken of it before. Some of them had, but most had not, because it was just such a terrifically, it was such a horrible mission. They were just, the sky was turned black with explosions of anti-aircraft shells. So it was a very traumatic and therefore vivid experience. And I became quite close with several of the men and corresponded or met with them for many years until they passed away. And unfortunately, they have now, as far as I know, all passed. But over the course of a decade or so, I did the research and the writing, and I landed a book deal. And I'm happy to say that the book is published as of March 26th.
And I'm looking at it right here, and I've read through it, and I wanted to have you on to tell us about the book, because I know that people will be captivated by the story, and you help them feel what these men felt and what they experienced. And voices a lot more significant than mine have certainly given you rave reviews, and that's all over the jacket of the book with General David Petraeus and Greg Freeman, who wrote The Forgotten 500, which a lot of people have read, Vincent Speranza, famous World War II veteran from the 101st Airborne. The list goes on and on, but I wanted you to tell us not just about the book, but to have your example for our listeners, because so often I'm told by someone who listens to this show, or I'm asked, you know, I had a father, a grandfather, an uncle, I don't know about what they did in World War II. And my encouragement is always to just start the journey, because you never know where it's going to lead. And I'm just struck by your desire to learn more about your uncle led to this whole project and these relationships you had, you said, with 55 men who flew that mission. I can only imagine that that's opened your eyes to a whole lot of things you never would have experienced before.
Indeed it did. And my goal was not just to tell the story, but to try to understand and then communicate to others, especially family members whose dads or uncles or grandfathers never spoke of it, communicate to them what they went through. I went very down into the weeds about what they wore, what combat was like, the sights and the smells and the sounds. And I wrote the book as if I was watching it happen, as if I was in the bombers myself. I have throughout my life been pretty good with the written word, and I think I came up with a compelling story. It's one that's very cinematic. I mean, a person picking up the book, I hope, will be drawn into the story and will be able to feel and smell really feel like they're in the bombers, because that's the way I intended it and that's the way I wrote it. But the advice I would give is just give it a try. I mean, I know a lot of the personnel records were lost in the fire in 1973 in the National Archives. My uncles were lost there as well. But with the internet and with, you know, Ancestry.com and many other resources today, Fold3.org is a very good resource. Just start digging and you'll never know. You know, you pull on one thread and many more will follow.
So maybe that strikes a chord with you today. Could there be a journey of discovery in your own family that's just waiting for you? To learn more about Mike Croissant's journey and his new book, Bombing Hitler's Hometown, go to MikeCroissant.com or link to it at HometownHeroesRadio.com. And when we come back, the ex-POW who shared his story on this program over a decade ago, who is a central figure in this captivating new book, Hometown Heroes, will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 1,800 veterans will have seen their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes. Celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with Mike Croissant, whose incredible new book, Bombing Hitler's Hometown, is the culmination of over a decade's worth of research and interviews with dozens of men who flew that fateful mission over Linz, Austria in late April 1945. In a moment, we're going to hear the memories of one of those men, as heard on this program way back in 2010. But first, Mike, I want to ask you about one of those men on that mission who you never had the chance to interview because he died shortly after returning from overseas in World War II. I'm talking about your uncle, Ellsworth Croissant. How much did you really know about your uncle when you were growing up?
My dad and he were 12 or 13 months apart in birth order. And they were very close. And I know that my uncle's death devastated him. My dad was quiet to begin with, and he never really talked about it. But throughout my life, I have distinct memories of my dad having a little lockbox. And every now and then, and in hindsight, it was probably the anniversary of my uncle's death. I don't know for sure, but he would get out this lockbox, and he would be looking through newspaper clippings about my uncle and as well as his photos. And like I said, he was quiet anyway, but he seemed deeply saddened, and that made me sad. And luckily, not long before my dad passed away, I got him to talk a little about it. I took what information I had and did some research, and I was able to locate a report that I purchased and studied about the accident that killed my uncle. And I was able to hopefully give the family some peace of mind, because the answers that the Army gave at the time were inadequate. They essentially didn't really understand why he had been taken from them at such a young age. So I did that, and that just left me wanting to do more, and that led me to this story. And Paul, I have to pause here and thank you, because you are one of the men who led me down this path. I mean, I was looking into one of the men on the mission, Dale Shabilsky. And in my search on the internet, I found the show where you interviewed him. And it was a very touching story. And I thank you for that. Between Dale's story, my uncle's story, and a couple of other crews that we could talk about, it quickly became for me not you could write a book about this. It became you have to write a book about this, and I thank you.
Well, thank you, and I'm just struck by, you know, your desire to give your family a gift and answer some questions and bring some closure is providing a gift to so many other families. And I'm sure the Shabelsky family is one that's going to feel that same way. Was it the letter that your uncle wrote about the Lynn's mission that kind of turned you on to that as the focal point of the book?
No, he mentions it very briefly. He wrote a letter to his parents, and it says, "Did I ever tell you about the Lynn's mission, the last mission to Lynn's?" And then he says that some of the men, some of the rookies, were stopping by his tent afterwards to congratulate him. He had been the lead bombardier for his squadron that day, and they clobbered the target. That's the only time he speaks of combat at all in any of the letters. But that's not why. The reason I focused on Lynn's was because not only the Hitler connection, but as I researched that specific mission on April 25th, I did find some things on the internet, you know, men who had written about it in bomb group association newsletters or whatnot. The accounts were always the same. It was a horrible mission. The sky was black with exploding clouds of shrapnel, and the men got shot to pieces. That was enough for me to at least start down the path. And then once I found your show and some other pieces, it was clear that I had to do this.
Well, let's listen to some of that show Mike's talking about, recorded Memorial Day weekend in 2010 in Mesa, Arizona, with Dale Shabelsky, who actually would have already been heading home with his required 35 missions complete if not for a twist of fate.
My regular crew had finished, but because I had to take time out to learn the radar, I was behind in the missions with them.
I know there's no such thing as a typical mission because each one was different, but can you give us a sense of what these missions entailed, what kind of targets you were after, and how smooth or not so smooth some of those missions were?
Well, most of the missions were around 10 hours long. We'd mostly go for supply lines, marshaling yards, airports, that type of deal, warehouses, and sometimes we'd go on what was called a terror raid, where we dropped screamer bombs, and they were effective.
Now, in 33 missions, I imagine that 33rd wasn't the first time you encountered flak or enemy fire. How often did that occur, and did you have some close calls before that final mission?
Yes, one time we had been over Auschwitz in Poland, and we had two engines knocked out, and we got a citation. We made the trip all the way back from Auschwitz in Poland to Italy on two engines without jettisoning anything. As a result of that, we got a recognition for not jettisoning and making the longest mission recorded on B-24 with two engines.
So you must have had a pretty hot shot pilot or some divine intervention or something, huh?
Some of both. We did lose altitude, and we were fortunate that there was a P-51 that tucked itself up underneath our right wing. He flew with us as long as he could, and then he had to peel off because of air fuel. And we made it on. By the time we got to Italy, we was only about 9,000 feet off the ground.
Wow. And I imagine when you did touch those wheels down, there's a pretty big sense of relief or maybe applause throughout the plane or what?
I was shooting flares out of the top of the plane so that the ground crew would be alerted to the fact that we didn't know if our wheels would collapse when we hit or not. But fortunately, everything gave us a smooth landing, and none of us were hurt.
Think there are a few prayers said in those moments?
Definitely. I know I did.
I'm not surprised. And when you survive a situation like that, do you say, okay, I've been through that, maybe we can get through anything, or do you say, wow, that was crazy, one of these days we're not going to make it back that way?
I never had a negative thought. I was ready to go whenever I needed to go. And No, I did a lot of praying.
Well, and someone did a lot of answering, because you're here talking to me today. That 33rd mission, what were you guys supposed to do that day? What went wrong, and how did you become a prisoner?
The Germans at that time were pulling back. We were out after another marshalling yard in Linz, Austria. Well, when we entered, I could tell that they were throwing everything up that they could. And there's three different kinds of flak, the regular flak, a red flak, and a white flak. Well, a white flak is a phosphorus flak. When it hit the airplane sides, it just eats the skin off the airplane. We had two engines knocked out over the target and one after that. You don't fly a B-24 on one engine. So we took a quick boat. We had a boat to either parachute out right then or try to crash land. So we've all voted for crash land because we'd heard too many stories about parachuting.
What kind of stories had you heard?
That the people on the ground were meeting us with pitchforks and just killing us right there on the way down. Well, we were down to about 5,000 feet, and we just couldn't hold the ground. We ended up in Gwyra, Hungary, and I can't tell you how far that is from Linz, Austria, but we crash-landed in Gwyra, Hungary.
What was that like? I imagine if you were scared the first time when you're shooting out the flares, this is taking it to another level, right?
That's right. I had been hit over the eye, over my right eye and in my seat. Our tail gunner got hit in both knees, and he was unable to get out of the turret without help. So, yeah, there was a lot of panic. Our ball turret gunner, he could not bring the ball turret back up, so they had to help pull him up out of there. And needless to say, our intercom system was gone wild. We had to tell people, cool, so you can get messages from the pilot and myself. Part of my responsibilities was to detonate the radar equipment to burn it up. And the bomb site, we had to detonate it, burn it up.
Because you didn't want the Germans seeing what technology you had.
That's right. And also, all the radio equipment had to be detonated and burned up. So that was my job, and it kept me pretty busy until we hit.
And what was it like when you hit? I can't imagine it was the smoothest landing you had experienced.
No, it was like a hitting up against a brick wall, and it was just a sudden stop. And as soon as we did, we saw all these civilian people coming out, rushing towards us. And your first thought is, goodbye. They weren't. They were friendly.
Well, it's a good thing they were. So here you are. You're wounded in a couple different spots. You've just hit a brick wall, as you described it, in the crash landing. You think you're going to die, but these folks are actually friendly. What happens to you from there?
We were flying a 13-man crew, and the 11 of them went one way. That none of them were wounded. I learned later on that they had gotten back to the base within 2 days. The tail turret gunner we had to leave behind because both knees were completely shot out. So he was left with the Germans. And later on, I found out that he also did a lot better than I did, that they replaced both of his knees. The Germans replaced both of his knees. He had steak and lamb and all that to eat. I had to go a different way. And to this day, I swear I went to some kind of a church basement. And a man came in, and he took 22 stitches over my eye. He cleaned out as much of the flak out of my seat as he could. And after that, the five men from the local underground said, we need to take you on. We can't keep you here because the Germans are on their way in. So anyhow, we walked from Gwyra, Hungary to Budapest, Hungary. At Budapest, Hungary, I gave myself up to what I thought was our allies, the Russians. As I approached, it was a big pond, and there was these soldiers all around it. And I go in with my hands up saying, Amerikansky, Amerikansky. Well, that didn't register. Underground felt like I should do away with my uniform. So they burned it and gave me civilian clothes to wear. Well, anyhow, when I got there, the only thing I could surmise is that the Russians felt like I was German because I was in civilian clothes, a blonde, blue-eyed, and I had Army 45, which they took, my dog tags they took because they just said, well, that, you know, I got them from somebody else. And the only thing I had that was GI was my shorts. undershorts.
So at that point, you're wishing you had your uniform back.
Yeah. They stripped me down to my shorts, tied my hands behind my back, and pointed to a building which was about 2 football fields away. And it was a cobble field. Well, being barefooted and your hands tied in your back, you don't do too good, especially when they try to run you. And I'd fall down, they'd come along, they'd kick me, and they'd hit me with the butts of their guns. By the time I got to the building, I had 4 teeth broken out, a busted nose, 3 ribs, 5 toes, and the wound over my eye opened again. And I was a mess by the time I got there.
What a nightmare. And you told me you never had a negative thought the entire time. How do you not have a negative thought in that situation? That's horrible.
At that time, all you're thinking is pray. So, and anyhow, we got to the building, and they just made me take a shower. Well, I thought, gee, I've read about this shower, you know, where it's poison to come down on you. Well, it wasn't. It was a real nice, hot, cold shower. And the idea was to wash the blood off of me. Well, all they did is let the water come down. My hands were still tied, so I couldn't do anything more. After they decided I was under the shower long enough, they pulled me out, went to this building and in a room, and they had a stool or a bench. They had me get up on the bench, untied my hands from the back of me, and tied me up on a beam with my hands over my head. But there was 2 women and 3 men come in, and they just started talking. I couldn't understand them, and they couldn't understand me. I kept saying, American consulate, American consulate. And anyhow, that didn't work too well. And finally, they brought in a officer, at least that's what I assumed, and he could talk broken English. And he had told me that if I didn't tell them the truth and what they wanted to know, that I would not see tomorrow. And he pointed to a woman, and he said, she will get the truth out of you. Well, what they did, they put a bunch of electric electrodes on you. Mm-hmm. And it must have been a low current, because when they activated it, my whole body, you just lose control of everything. They'd leave it on, I'd pass out, they'd wake me up, turn it on again. And I don't know how many times this occurred. But I finally decided I'm going to make up a story. And I said, there's 10,000 airplanes ready to come over to you, and you better be ready. That did not go over good. So I said, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it was 100. That went over all right. Then they were saying something else, this woman, and I couldn't understand her. And so she got real mad at me, and she had a rifle, and she came to the back of me and just really beat me up in my back. Came back in front and stuck the rifle or the barrel of the gun right in my face. Well, I still couldn't understand her. All I could say is American consulate. So it ended up that this man said, okay, we're going to leave you here overnight and let you think about it. And when we come back, you better be ready to tell us. Well, again, I don't know how long, but I know I was there long enough where I no longer had any feeling in my arms. It was just completely, you know, like they were dead. And they had turned out the lights, so it was pure dark in there. And whenever they came back, they showered me with water, woke me up, and again, I couldn't feel anything. And I thought, well, go ahead and kill me. You know, what have I got to lose? And they decided that I was telling them everything I could. Well, when they let me down on the floor, I just collapsed. And they drugged me out of there, and I don't know how. They put me in like what I call a closet, because it wasn't long enough for me to lay down and stretch out, but I could curl up. And they kept me in there. Then they came got me and tried to interrogate me again. Of course, I was too weak to say anything. They take me back, and all I had to in there with me was a bucket. And once a day, I had a tin can full of some kind of liquid and green stuff, once a day. That went on for a period of time. I kept saying American consulate. And finally, the war was over. Finally got an audience with American consulate. Well, they interviewed me, and they said, well, it's going to take about a week to 10 days to verify that what you said is true, because they check your family and all that kind of stuff. Well, they did come back, but on the interim time, the one officer said that if I said anything about how I was treated, I wouldn't see tomorrow. And he said, I'll be there when you talk to him. And you say one thing out of line, you're dead. So when they came back, they interviewed me, and they said, yeah, we're going to set you out for free. And this was 30 days at least after I'd been longer than that, about 2.5 months, that all this transpired. And finally, I got to, they freed me. The soldier that was there wished me luck. They had a banquet for me. They had a big roast pig on the table, full pig. And they had poured me a goblet full of what I thought was water. I didn't know any better. And man, having not had any water for so long, I bottomed up. Well, I passed out.
Vodka?
Vodka. I truthfully don't know how long I was passed out, but when I woke up, I was back in this little closet room. And I finally woke up, and I knocked on the door until somebody came. And they finally gave me some clothes that I could put on. They were kind of big. Anyhow, we had the banquet again. I don't know if it was the same roast pig or not, but anyhow, there was another roast pig. And this time they poured me this glass, and accidentally on purpose, I hit it and it fell on the floor. I never drank anymore. Because I was a guest of honor, I got the first slice off the pig. Well, it was 100 total fat. Well, I thought to myself, I can't eat that. I haven't had any food for 6 months. So somehow that slipped off on the floor, and I got a piece of ham later and some vegetables. And about a week after that banquet, the American people arranged for me to go down to the seaport in Kiev. I got on this English ship, and we went from Kiev over the Black Sea back to Italy. Well, when I got back to the base was deactivated. There was a dentist apprentice and a couple of the base commander and a couple others in one tent. Well, I came down with malaria, and they did the best they could for me then. And the colonel said, well, do you think you'd be ready to fly in about a week? I said, as far as I'm concerned, I'm ready to go now. So anyhow, after about a week, we did fly, and we went back to the States. My folks had been told early that I was missing in action, and then they came and said I was KIA, and they paid them the $10,000. And of course, none of this I knew about. So anyhow, when I got back to the States, I called home. You know, well, my brother answered the phone, and he said, who is this? And I said, Jack, you dummy, I'm your brother, Dale. And he said, you're dead. We told you you're dead. Well, all I can say is that the good Lord blessed me. And being younger than that, I guess that you can survive some of those things. I didn't think I would.
The late Dale Shabilsky, a central figure in the new book, Bombing Hitler's Hometown, by Mike Croissant. Learn all about it online at mikecroissant.com or link to it at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll hear more from the author when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. it's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is Mike Croissant, author of the new book, Bombing Hitler's Hometown. All the links are there for you at hometownheroesradio.com. And Mike, I am so impressed that you were able to track down 55 men who flew this mission, including Dale Shabilsky, whose memories we just listened to. When you think of that group as a whole, are there some commonalities that emerge through all those conversations? Because I kind of get the impression that these men made a pretty powerful impression on you.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great question. The things that connect them, they all loved aviation. They all volunteered. Not a single one that I spoke with waited to be drafted. And they all suffered for what they went through. Not all of them admitted it, but the ones that I really got to know and developed trust with really began to unburden themselves with just how deeply aerial combat affected them. You know, in these bombers, they were flying between 25 and 30,000 feet, depending on which aircraft they were in. These aircraft were not pressurized, so wind was whipping through those aircraft. They had to be on oxygen in order to breathe, because obviously the air is too thin up there to sustain human life. And they had to wear suits that plugged into little sockets and produced heat throughout their body. And that's before even meeting the enemy in battle. So just that aspect of it alone was maybe not traumatic, but definitely not fun to experience. Then you throw in the aerial combat aspect. You know, by this point in the war, the German Air Force was largely destroyed or grounded by the lack of fuel and pilots. So very little combat with fighters was happening at this time. In fact, there's only one case that I know of that happened on April 25th. Of a German fighter making a run at one of the bombers. But where the Germans lacked the ability to attack with fighters, they made up for in throwing up a lot of anti-aircraft fire. It was called flak. Flak comes from a German word that I will not attempt to say that stands for anti-aircraft artillery cannon. Flak is essentially an artillery shell that explodes and produces shrapnel. So it's called flak. The flak that was produced that day blotted out the sun, according to what many of the men said. It was like flying into a storm cloud. One of the most vivid descriptions of it I got was from a man named John Dominey, whose nickname was Duck. You probably recognize his name from the book, but yep. he's in the ball turret, which is the spherical gun turret underneath one of the B-24s near the front of the formation. And he is rotating his turret, scanning for fighters, and he hears his nose gunner say, flak 12 o'clock level over the intercom. So Duck rotates his turret to the front of the aircraft, and what he sees terrifies him, and he says, I'm paraphrasing here, I knew that I was going to die. The flak was like a solid black cloud. So Duck begins to say the Lord's Prayer, and he knows that he doesn't have time to say the whole thing. So he pauses and he asks God if he will have him. And he's filled with a sense of peace. And then he enters the flak zone. And within minutes, the bomber is devastated with fire, and they would eventually all have to parachute out. So needless to say, the flak that day and on other days, but especially on this day, April 25th, left the men traumatized. Many of them, including John Dominey, couldn't enjoy 4th of July fireworks anymore after this. Later in life, John would be with his baby brother. A car would backfire, and the next thing knew, John was taking cover under the porch, and he found his baby brother out in the street alone. So the men who survived the mission, and fortunately it was the great majority of them, still carried invisible wounds with them after the war. I go into this a lot. The whole back portion of the book is how the men got home from the mission, including the men who were shot down, but also how they went on with life. You know, these men were 18 to, say, 26 years old and have these very formative events at such a young age. That left an impression, to say the least. The back part of the book deals with that, and I hope will help many of the families who read it to understand just why their loved ones never talked about it.
Well, and that's what struck me as you're sharing is, you know, I've met so many who say when they hear stories like what you're talking about, it helps them understand things about their father, their grandfather, their uncle. We see that on the honor flights too. They start to realize this is not a unique experience to my family, and having someone talk about it helps them understand. And I know everybody listening got goosebumps when you told the story of Duck preparing to go through that cloud of flak, and we can only imagine. You mentioned those who got captured, and Dale Shabilsky was one of those who got captured. And I want people to get the book so you don't have to tell us everything, but was there an element of Dale's very unique experience that really kind of gripped you or told you, yeah, that has to be in the book?
Oh, how could it not? Dale, boy, young man, youngest of three kids from Omaha, Nebraska. He becomes a radio operator. He initially tries to become a pilot, but his entire class has washed out for the convenience of the government, they say, essentially because there were too many pilots. So he becomes a radio operator and gunner. He's very close to finishing his combat tour. The men had to complete 35 combat missions in order to go home. April 25th is Dale's 33rd mission. So he can see the end, but unfortunately, the Germans have a say in it. And just, I think, 11 minutes into the battle, Dale feels the aircraft lift when the bombs drop from the bomb bay because all of the weight has been, dropped. He turns from his radio table toward the bomb bay because one of his jobs is to verify that all of the bombs had indeed fallen out. As he does that, a black cloud bursts through the bomb bay. A shell has just exploded very near the aircraft. The shockwave knocks him off his feet. He gets up and goes to brush away what he thinks is sweat from above his right eye and learns that it's blood. His glove comes away red. The tail gunner is wounded as well, and the aircraft cannot stay in the air much longer. They effect a crash landing in Hungary in an area that's under Soviet control. And a group of Hungarian partisans rushes to the scene. They take the men who are not wounded and spirit them away. They take the tail gunner in one direction and Dale in another. Dale learns at that point that he's also been wounded in the buttocks by flak. The partisans prevail on Dale to shed his American uniform and his identity papers, and he keeps only his dog tags and his .45 pistol. He is wearing Hungarian civilian clothes. They essentially walk to Budapest, and the Hungarians convinced Dale to give himself over to the Soviets. They're huddling on the bank of the river in Budapest. They see a Soviet patrol. they part ways, and Dale gives himself up to the Soviets. They approach him and disarm him and start to talk to him. And very soon, because Dale is blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and pale-skinned, they presumably take him to be a German spy, and they begin to beat him. This is only the beginning, and over the next few days, they subject Dale to horrific torture, and I will not go into it here. It's all in the book. But for days and days, Dale Shabelsky is tortured by the Soviets. He gives his name, rank, and serial number, and requests to be turned over to the American consulate. He is often just beaten harder or laughed at for doing that. However, eventually the Soviets give in for reasons I don't know, but they put Dale on a series of transports. He ends up in Odessa in the Soviet Ukraine, and there rejoins his crew. And they are placed on a ship and returned to Italy. And soon after, Dale returns to the United States. So it's a tale that had to be in the book. There's no way I could not tell it. I did speak to Dale once before he passed. He unfortunately passed away not long after we spoke in 2014 at the age of 89. He did suffer from nightmares, as one could only imagine. But I do think that by the end, he had made peace with what had happened to him. His daughter had intervened and gotten him to finally begin talking about it and writing about it. He wrote a memoir that I was given access to, and he began speaking to audiences, particularly young people, about his war experiences and also to you. And I'm very glad he did that. It was a great interview. But anyway, Dale Shabelsky, God bless him, a great American, and I'm glad that his story will now be available for the world to know. Because it should be known.
Well, absolutely, especially if anybody picks up this book, Bombing Hitler's Hometown, The Untold Story of the Last Mass Bomber Raid of World War II in Europe. And, Mike, as we wrap up, and if there's anything you didn't have a chance to share that you really want people to hear, feel free. But I want to ask you what might not be the easiest question in the world. Your inspiration, the start of this journey that has led to such a bigger picture than I'm sure you ever imagined, was your late uncle, who was part of this mission, who tragically died in that crash after coming home from World War II, Uncle Ellsworth. If Uncle Ellsworth were thumbing through the pages of this new book, what do you think he would be struck by? How do you think he would feel about all this?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I hope he would be grateful that someone cared enough to tell a story. From what I can piece together, I did speak to his last surviving crewmate, who just so happened to be his best friend. And Bill was his name. Bill described Ellsworth as very quiet, very happy-go-lucky, didn't drink, didn't smoke, didn't gamble. That's how I picture my uncle. So I think reading the book, reading how much he loved America, how much he loved his mother. You know, his mother is extensively in the chapter about his death, how much he loved his sisters and his brothers. I think he would be pleased. And I plan very soon to visit his grave and leave a copy of the book. And because this journey started with me visiting his grave and promising him, I'm getting emotional. Promising him that I would tell a story. So I have kept that promise. So the book is for him and for all the others who went on the mission, and especially those who didn't make it back.
Well, I'm sure I'm not alone with everyone listening and just wanting to say thank you, Mike, for doing that. Thank you for picking up this mantle and for providing something to so many families that maybe nobody else could. It sure seems like you are uniquely positioned and motivated to do this. And I know we're just getting the initial taste of how big an impact it's going to have. But congratulations on getting to the finish line with this book. Hope everybody listening will order a copy and read it. And maybe this feedback that they share with you will lead to another project down the road. Is there anything else that you want our listeners to know?
I would just say if you want to learn more, you can go to my website. It's MikeCroissant.com or BombingHitler'sHometown.com. And I want to thank you again, Paul, for nudging me down this path and for giving me your time today.
Well, thank you. An outstanding job. That is Mike Croissant, author of Bombing Hitler's Hometown. Again, those sites he mentioned are linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, where you'll find a few more comments from Mike that wouldn't fit into our radio time today. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us on Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
And as promised, there's a little bit more of our conversation with Mike that didn't fit into the radio time, but you can listen to it here online. And don't forget to check out the links for Bombing Hitler's Hometown, the new book by Mike Croissant.
I want to really understand your motivation and the connections that you made with this. And with regard to your uncle, did his story, his sacrifice, did that have anything to do with your desire to serve our country?
You know, I've often wondered about that. Given his being in the Air Force, my dad was a private pilot. I had the aviation bug bite me pretty early in life, but I did unsuccessfully try to become an Air Force officer. It's a long story. Essentially, in Air Force ROTC in college, I developed drug-resistant bronchitis for 10 months, and it hamstrung me so badly that I just wasn't able to continue, and I took that as a sign that I was meant to do other things. But, yes, for sure, the aviation interest on my own part made this project a lot easier to take on. If it were a naval story or something I was less familiar with, it would have been a much different undertaking for me.
Well, and, you know, if people read your book, and I was just looking at chapter 18 about Dale Shabilsky, and again, we'll talk about that, but, you know, on the back jacket, it says, drawing on interviews with dozens of America's last surviving World War II veterans, as well as previously unpublished sources, Mike Croissant, a CIA officer and an established expert in intelligence and foreign affairs, compellingly relates one of the war's last truly untold stories. And of course, it's no longer untold as of March 26th with the publishing of this book. And I've met several veterans over the years who've spent some time in the Central Intelligence Agency, as you did, and usually they can't talk about much of what they did. But is there anything you'd like to share with our audience about the people who work for that agency and how your experience colors your perspective on that?
Sure. And I realize now I didn't fully answer your last question. I grew up and still am extremely patriotic. I love my country, and I always wanted to serve. When the Air Force door closed on me, I just sought a new one. And because I've always been interested in current events, the CIA was deeply appealing to me. And luckily for me, right as I was finishing my second master's degree in Bloomington, Indiana, they came recruiting, and I was able to land an interview and got in, started in December 1999, served for about 22 years. They're the best Americans that you can imagine. They're to a man and to a woman. They are dedicated, smart, extremely patriotic, and dedicated to keeping America safe. I met some of the absolute finest people that walked the earth during my time there. I served during a time of great upheaval. I was a rookie when 9/11 happened. I was in the building that day. And for many years after, served in a couple of pretty sketchy places, including a war zone. Worked in counterterrorism, worked as an analyst. And I'm very glad I did it. However, I was gone a lot, and my family, I think, started to suffer for that. So I decided to call it quits after more than two decades, with a little bit of regret, but not much. I don't regret anything I did. I'm glad I served, and should I ever be needed again, I would be happy to go back. But it's under the care of much better and smarter people now that I'm gone.